Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's the beginning of a new school year, which means many students are heading off to college, and others are wondering how they're going to pay for this next level of their education. College costs have risen a whopping 1,120% since 1978. The majority of college students have no choice but to take out loans to attend school. The average graduate now leaves school owing almost $30,000 in debt. Nationwide, there's an estimated $1 trillion in outstanding student loans. Younger students attending college for the first time may not understand what they're signing when they take out loans. Educational loans have very few consumer protections. They cannot be discharged in bankruptcy, and debt collectors have the ability to garnish wages, Social Security, and disability checks if payments aren't made promptly. This puts student loans on the same level as criminal debt, unpaid child support, and delinquent taxes. And with an unemployment rate of almost 11% for 2013 college graduates, many are now struggling to repay those loans. Homeowners can refinance their loans when interest rates go down. Businesses also can do the same, but there's no way for students to do that. So today we're going to talk about the best options to pay for college. If you or your child is heading off to college for the first time, what do you want to know about student loans and financial aid? And if you're trying to repay your loans, what repayment options are best for you? Well, joining us to answer all of these questions and more, Betsy Mayotte is Director of Regulatory Compliance at the American Student Assistance, which is a nonprofit that helps students and alumni successfully manage and repay their college loan debt. Hi, Betsy.
Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Megan McLean, who's Director for Policy and Advocacy at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, which is an organization that works to remove barriers and provide education for student financial aid. Hi, Megan.
Good morning.
Good morning to both of you. And I'll give out the number in just a moment for students and parents and others, those who are in the university and college systems here in the Bay Area and in Northern California, to join our conversation. And I've been wading through this myself for a couple of days, so I feel for students and parents who are looking at all of this information. So, Megan, let's start off really basic. Who offers financial aid for college?
That is a great first question, and the answer is that financial aid for college actually comes from several different sources. So when we hear about student loans that you were just talking about a minute ago, I think most commonly we think of financial assistance that comes from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing to remember is there is also financial assistance available at the state level and sometimes the institutional level, and then even more locally, there are private scholarships available as well. So there are a lot of different sources.
But scholarships are different than loans.
They are.
Mm-hmm. But there are also private loans that are not federal loans.
That's right. There are private loans as well. So there are private loans, federal loans. There's grant aid at the federal level. There is grant aid and loans at the state level, depending on where you are. And it varies from institution to institution, but a lot of times institutions also have some of their own funds to give students.
And then there's federally backed loans, which are private in like Sallie Mae, which used to be government run and no longer is.
Right now we have a full direct loan system, which are federally backed loans, but there are also private loans that are issued by private lenders.
So what do you think are the best places for students to apply for aid, and when should they apply?
You know, early and often is the message when you're talking about applying for financial aid, and the very first step is to fill out the federal government's form, which is the free application for federal student aid, or the FAFSA, and that becomes available on January 1st of every year. And the reason it's important is that even though I just mentioned that states and institutions and sometimes even local governments have other forms of financial aid, many times they use the information that you provided on the federal form. So you should think about that as your first step, and you should do it as early as you can.
All right, and I'm going to go ahead and invite listeners to join our conversation. You can also email us at feedback@yourcall.org, or you can go to our website where there's information about student debt, student loans, and repayment, which is yourcallradio.org. You can post comments there, or you can call us and join this conversation. 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. If you're heading to college for the first time, how are you paying for it? What concerns do you have about student loans and taking on debt? 866-798-8255. And if you're the parent of a new college student, what is your plan to help your child pay for college? What do you want to know about educational loans? Again, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255, or feedback@yourcallradio.org. Okay, so you talked about federal loans, and the Federal Direct Loan Program is the largest federal student loan program run by the U.S. Department of Education. Talk to us about those loans.
Sure. Those loans are available for both undergraduate and graduate students, and you get your eligibility for those loans by filling out the free application for federal student aid.
That's the FAFSA.
The FAFSA. At the undergraduate level, we have two types of federal student loans. At a very high level, we have subsidized loans and unsubsidized loans. Subsidized loans are where the federal government pays the interest while the student is in school, and with unsubsidized loans, the federal government does not pay the interest. The subsidized loans are actually a form of a need-based loan, which is why it's important to fill out the application so that the government can take your information and determine your family's need and figure out what type of loan you are eligible for.
And so what's the difference, say, when I get out of college, if I had had a subsidized loan versus an unsubsidized loan? What kind of debt am I looking at with one versus the other?
Yeah, you know, it would be difficult to say because students borrow different amounts with different interest rates, but the subsidized loan, the need-based loan, you would leave college with a less amount of debt because you didn't have that interest accruing while you were in college.
And how much money can students get from federal loans?
You know, there are different loan limits, but and they can be quite complex, but generally speaking, first-year undergraduates can borrow up to $3,500. Second-year students can borrow up to $4,500, and students in their third, fourth, and fifth years can borrow up to $5,500.
Okay, so that's mostly going to subsidize a public education.
You know, it varies from institution to institution, but we are finding that more and more students are financing their education with loans as opposed to grants.
And so that's direct subsidized loans, direct unsubsidized loans, both mm-hmm. part of the federal loan program, and then there's something called direct plus loans and direct consolidation loans.
Yes, that's true as well. But I would say for the viewers in the audience, I think the important thing for them to know is these general loan limits. The PLUS loans actually deal with graduate students and parents. So those are basically kind of what we can think of as supplemental loans, essentially. So if you're attending an institution where, let's say, you borrow up to the federal amount and you still have need, the parent, for example, of the undergraduate could apply for a federal PLUS loan, which is still a federal loan and really kind of supplements what the student has borrowed. Same case for graduate students.
And that's Megan McLean. She's Director for Policy and Advocacy at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. We're talking about student debt. It's Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're also joined by Betsy Mayotte, who's Director of Regulatory Compliance at the American Student Assistance, which is a nonprofit that helps students and alumni successfully manage and repay college loan debt. So, Betsy, what should students and parents watch out for when they're applying for loans? Are there signs of sort of something that might be a subprime, a predatory lending situation?
Well, we always advise families to start with the federal and state programs first. If you aren't receiving enough aid and you need to go outside those federal programs into the private program, you want to research this like you would research any other type of consumer good. If you're looking at several different private lenders, look at their reviews, look at their Better Business Bureau profiles. Ask the school. The financial aid office is going to be the trusted agent. They've done oftentimes a lot of the sort of legwork for you to ensure that they're getting, or hopefully getting, the best deal that they can for their students.
And I've heard anecdotally that some private colleges may have specific loans tied to those colleges. Is that apocryphal? Is that untrue?
There are some schools do have what we call institutional loan programs. They're not as prevalent as they were several years ago, but that can be another loan product. But again, the consumer should always do their research like they would on any other type of loan when they're choosing a lender.
And what kind of new consumer protections do we have in place, like say over the past decade?
Oh, the number of disclosures and the clarity of those disclosures has increased exponentially in the last 10 years. So, the downside to that means there's an awful lot to read when someone takes out a student loan. But the upside is that if the consumer is a good consumer and they read those disclosures, there should be no surprises at any point during the life of that loan. They've also made sure that they've clarified some of the regulations to ensure, you brought up institutional loans a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
They've put some very strong regulations in place to make sure that the school is looking out for the student's best interest if they are going to choose to recommend a particular private loan or other type of lender. The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau has come into play and is doing some very strong oversight on both the federal and the private loan programs. So that's sort of another bodyguard, so to speak, that's watching out on behalf of the consumer. Does that mean that consumers don't still have to be aware? Of course not. You should always, as I said a minute ago, you should always be make sure you're doing all your reading and understand the terms of whatever debt that you're taking on.
And with private loans, a lot of the time you need a co-signer. So can you talk about the responsibilities of a co-signer? Say you're a parent or a guardian or an aunt or an uncle and you're co-signing.
This is a great question. Unfortunately, a question that I get a lot is, I agreed to be a co-signer on the loan and now the person isn't paying. I don't want to do this anymore. And that's sort of the point of co-signing. You're agreeing to be equally liable in a lot of cases for that loan debt if the person isn't able to pay. It's really important to read the terms of the co-signing. There are some private lenders that if the borrower should become disabled or pass away, the loan will go away and the co-signer won't be responsible. But in a lot of cases, again, the co-signer would be responsible. Some advice that we're seeing that I think is great advice is that if you do have to go into the private loan sector and you do have to get a co-signer for your private loans, it might be a good idea to take out life insurance in the amount of what that private loan debt might be. So if, God forbid, something terrible were to happen, you're not leaving that burden.
Yeah, because student loans do not get discharged with death, so co-signers will be hit with the debt if the student dies. And we've seen examples of that.
Right. Federal student loans actually do get discharged on the death of the borrower or the death of the student for whom the loan was for. Some private loan lenders are actually starting to add that as a condition, but not all of them. So it's important to read the promissory note.
And in part, they're starting to do that because of the publicity around some kind of high-profile cases where a student has died and the co-signer is left with, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. What about students who are first generation going to college for the first time in the history of their family, for example? Maybe their parents don't speak English as a native language. What kinds of particular hazards do those students face? Are they more likely to enter into sort of a predatory loan type situation?
Well, I don't know if I would use the word predatory. I would use the word uneducated. What we're seeing, Parent Plus loans, which is a great resource to sort of subsidize if there's not enough direct financial aid available for the student to attend school. The great thing about Parent Plus loans is that even though there is a credit check for them, it's fairly mild. The bad thing, or what could be considered a bad thing for Parent Plus loans, is there's no debt to income or ability to pay component as part of that credit check. So what we're starting to see more of is families with a fairly low household income, and again, you brought up first generation college students, being awarded $20,000, $40,000, $60,000 or more in Parent PLUS loans. And they, because of the language barrier, they may just assume, well, they wouldn't have given, this is going to sound very familiar, like the mortgage crisis, they wouldn't have given me the loan if they didn't think I could afford to pay it.
Right.
So it's really important that the whole family understands the implications of that level of loan debt and what that's going to mean for a payment amount. Unfortunately, Parent PLUS loans don't have all the benefits that some of the other federal loan products do, in particular access to the different, most of the different income-based repayment options. So we're really seeing some families struggling because of that.
And that's Betsy Mayotte, Director of Regulatory Compliance at American Student Assistance, a nonprofit that helps students and alumni successfully manage and repay their college loan debt. We're talking about student debt. The average college graduate owes almost $30,000 in loans. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. I'm also joined by Megan McLean, who's Director for Policy and Advocacy at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, which is an organization that works to remove barriers and provide education for student financial aid. And we want to invite you to join our conversation. 866-798-TALK is the toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Call and tell us about your student debt and your prospects for work and repayment. Are you working to repay those student loans back right now? Do you have any questions about which repayment plan is best for you or any tips to share with our audience? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you're the parent of a new college student, do you have a plan to pay for your for college, and what concerns do you have about student loans? Let's go to Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to your call. Uh-oh, did I lose? I just lost Joe. Looks like I... Sorry, Joe.
Sorry,
all right.
Joe.
We'll get to more questions in just a moment. But if students say don't have... and if students are not able to cover their expenses from federal or state loans, what are the best options for private loans? Is there a difference as you're balancing those private loan options? Megan?
You know, I would defer to what Betsy said earlier and just make sure that students really make sure that they are educated on the terms and conditions of the loans. There are so many different products out there that, you know, I couldn't say off the top of my head what would be, you know, the best one. But we also encourage students to work with their institutions and their financial aid offices to discuss with them the prospects of a private loan. And our administrators are counselors as well, so they would be willing to sit down with students and look at the different loans and talk through the terms and conditions.
And who in Congress is really on top of these issues? I know that Elizabeth Warren had two bills, one that called for college loans to be issued at the same nearly free interest rates that Wall Street banks received from the Fed, and then another proposal to refinance outstanding student loan debt at less than 4% interest, and those both failed. But she now has a bill that would lower student interest rates back down to what they were last year. So I guess interest rates for federal loans increased this year. Can you both explain what happened and talk about who's advocating for students and for regulation of student debt?
Sure. Well, I would just say that the good news is that there's a great interest in Capitol Hill generally in college costs, affordability, transparency, both in the House and Senate on both sides of the aisle, and also very much a great interest from the Obama administration. And student loan interest rates have been a big part of those legislative efforts and public policy initiatives. And for quick background, last summer, in July 1 of 2013, we actually passed a bill that would tie interest rates to the market rate. So prior to that, federal student loan interest rates were basically set in law, and they were written into law 5 or 6 years in advance, concrete numbers, not taking into account what was going on with external economic conditions. Last year, we passed...
Wait, Megan, was that because that way students would know what their debt was, so that if the interest rates rose really astronomically, they wouldn't be... What was the rationale for that?
You know, I think it was really to kind of insert an element of predictability into the process, but we saw what happened. You know, that bill passed in 2007 that did that. We saw what happened in 2008 with the economic downturn, and then realized really that these numbers were very out of whack with what was going on in the current economy, and it was actually, they were much worse for students than had they just had followed the market. So we really advocated heavily for that bill, as did a lot of other higher education organizations, because we felt like the student federal student loans really should better reflect what's going on in the market. Now, what Senator Warren was talking about with her bill was giving students a chance to refinance their interest rates, particularly students who are not able to take advantage of this new law that ties the interest rates to the market, because it was just for new loans on or after July 1st of 2013. So really opening up the window and giving students a chance who were borrowers before that to take advantage of these better rates.
And is there anybody else in Congress who's really on top of this, Betsy?
Yeah, there's actually been quite a bit of activity. We have they've been doing a lot of work on the Higher Education Act, and I think we're going to see that at least over the next year. Senator Harkin out of Iowa put out a draft. It's 800 pages of reading if anyone's interested. That suggests quite a few significant and really beneficial to the student changes out there. Patty Murray out of Washington has always been an advocate for students. She's also on the Senate Education Committee. On the House side, John Klein out of Minnesota, Tom Petrie out of Wisconsin, Congressman McKean out of California has been an advocate for students and paid a lot of attention to federal financial aid programs for many, many years, and he's still quite active in that as well.
And let's go to a caller. Let's go to Jody in Oakland. Hi, Jody. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I got a question. If I get into a teaching program and at a university, put out about $7,000, and that program goes belly up, so could not finish the program because it went belly up, is there any way for me to collect money or not pay the student loan? I mean, what do I do?
Yeah, Jody, if you were attending the school within 120 days of the time that the school went belly up, as you put it, then you could be eligible on your federal student loans for something called a closed school loan discharge. And the way you would apply for that is to just contact whomever's holding your loan, and they can send you the application for you to fill out.
Well, the school didn't close, just their program was discontinued.
Okay, if that's the case, and there was some question about how they, the first thing I would do would be to talk to the school to see if there's some way they could allow you to complete the program at another institution at no cost to you. If you don't receive a satisfactory answer on that respect, I would consider contacting your state attorney general's office to see if there's something they can do to help you.
So Kamala Harris, okay. Harris's office. Jody, did you have more questions? Go ahead.
I got one more question, yes. Okay, let's say my wife got student loans and she stopped paying her student loans. Do I have to pay her student loans?
If these are federal loans, it's unless for some reason you guys put together an old product called a spousal consolidation, which I hope you didn't, you shouldn't have any responsibility for your wife's student loans. If she had private student loans and you co-signed for them, then it is possible that you would absolutely have some responsibility towards those loans.
And
okay.
Jody, we're about to go to a break. If you have more questions, just stay on the line. We're speaking about student debt. The average college graduate now leaves owing almost $30,000 in debt. Nationwide, there's an estimated $1 trillion in outstanding student loans. So what do students need to know to understand before signing a loan, and what can graduates with debt do to reduce that load? We're speaking with Betsy Mayotte, who's Director of Regulatory Compliance at American Student Assistance, and Megan McLean, Director for Policy and Advocacy at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this break.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. When you buy or sell a home, choosing the right agent is the most important decision you'll make. You can connect with an effective agent in your area and support local public radio. Learn more at kalw.org/mybrokerdonates.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about student debt and what families should know before taking it on. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. You can subscribe to our podcast at our website, which is also where you'll find information about upcoming shows, yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, how diverse are environmental organizations? A new study shows that people of color are significantly underrepresented in environmental groups, especially at the leadership level. So is there a green ceiling for activists of color in the environmental movement? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable. We'll speak with journalists about the week's news. Today, we're asking what is the best way to pay for college? And if you want to join our conversation, the number is 866-798-8255. We especially want to hear from students with debt. How are you dealing with that? And parents and students contemplating acquiring debt to get an education. 800-798-TALK. That's 800-798-8255. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And you can look at links to information about all this at yourcallradio.org, post information there or post comments. And Jody, I wanted to make sure that I didn't give you short shrift. Did you have more questions? Do we have Jody? All right, then let's go to Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Your Call.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So
you're on, Joe.
All right. Hello.
Hi, Joe. You need to turn down your radio, otherwise you're getting delayed. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're on, Jody. Joe.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. So I'm calling about my daughter's application for financial aid this year. She's a first-year college student, and she applied to a bunch of schools, got into six of them, and they kept doing things like they would give her like a huge grant, like $25,000, and that would sound wonderful. But then they kept hiding the total cost for the school. They would never hand it out right away, and then all of a sudden they'd send the bill, and it would turn out to be $60,000, and the rest was all loans. And those loans were coming in from the schools as unsubsidized, and they were like 8.5% accruing immediately. And I was, like, so blown away by that. And then I got thinking about the future, and I said, if all these kids come out of college and they've got all this debt, what's going to happen to the future consumer economy? Who can afford houses and cars or refrigerators or, you know, anything if they're going to be saddled with hundreds of dollars of debt every month?
Well, stick around, Joe, because you've got a lot of questions embedded there. Let's first talk about your experience, both the front end and the back end. So, Megan, what kind of disclosure do universities have to give students and parents about what kind of debt they're actually taking on versus what part is a grant or a scholarship?
Well, the institutions do have to give award letters to students, or sometimes called financial aid notification letters. And I think, Joe, that's what you're talking about, that if your daughter applied to six different colleges or universities, she probably got six different letters. And in those award letters, they are to go through and, you know, talk about what the cost of attendance is, any grants or scholarships that the student may have received, that, again, can be coming from different sources, and then also any loans that the students might receive. You know, there is no standard format for financial aid letters right now, but it is, you know, the best practices of institutions to clearly label what is a loan and let students know what will have to be repaid. Betsy mentioned earlier there's a whole host of disclosures that students receive as well, and sometimes that comes with the financial aid letter that talks to students about what a loan is, that a loan is not free money, that it's not grant money, that it will need to be repaid. With the federal student loans, there are disclosures that come along that students, after graduating or leaving school, have 6 months grace period, and then they'll have to start to begin to make payments.
After the student has graduated.
That's right.
So,
or
but
left,
part,
or
pardon
permanently.
Okay, so pardon my ignorance here, but is there just one form that all universities have to use that is uniform across schools that really does show you exactly what you're getting in a scholarship and exactly what you're going to owe and at what rate?
There is not a uniform form right now. Our organization has actually done some work on this issue to try to standardize terminology and elements that would need to appear on all award letters, and this is something that I think folks are also interested in Congress as well. I will say that the disclosures that have to be given related to the federal student loans in terms of their loans or in terms of their terms and conditions are standardized. So students are all receiving the same disclosures. But as far as the actual award letter, right now the institutions have flexibility to present that to the students that makes the most sense for the population that they're serving.
Whatever they say makes the most sense for the population that they're serving. So let me bring Joe back into this and Betsy. So what about what Joe says about payments starting so soon? Joe, were you saying that even before your student graduated?
Well, no. It's just that the balance is going to accrue really high by the time they start paying off their loans. If it's just cranking along at 8.5% annually from the time they start borrowing it.
Right. You bring up a really good point, Joe. And anytime there is a borrower, a student borrower, or a parent borrower for that matter, has an unsubsidized loan, meaning the interest begins accruing right from day one, it's very rare for them to be required to pay that interest while they're in school. So we always advise them to pay that interest as they go, even though they're not required, for the reason that you described, because if it's not paid, the balance ends up increasing and can increase quite a bit by the time that the student leaves school. I also wanted to bring a tool up that, you mentioned being caught off guard because you got this fabulous grant and then all of a sudden you realize what the actual cost of attendance is. There's an awesome tool out there that I encourage all families looking at colleges to use. It's by the Department of Education and it's called the College Navigator. And what's great about the College Navigator is it gives you what the average net cost, meaning after the average aid package is given to their students. And it allows families to really do an apples-to-apples comparison of the different institutions that they're looking at and get an idea of what an average financial aid package looks like at that school and therefore how much it's really going to cost out of pocket, whether that be through loans or writing a check.
And Joe brings up another question. I mentioned that nationwide there's an estimated $1 trillion in outstanding student loans, and he says, what's the effect of this on the consumer economy? If all of these students are coming out so riddled with debt, how is that going to affect both their prospects for work and life and our economy as a whole?
Well, I mean, that's definitely a concern that everyone's looking at. I mean, we're already seeing some results of the increase in student debt, which is, people are waiting longer to buy houses. People are waiting longer to have children. People are waiting longer to get married. And I think we're only really starting to look at those effects because college debt has really only increased as so quickly in the last 10 or 15 years. So I think we definitely have some policy decisions to make or at least to think through, and we do need to look at the effects of the potential effects of what that debt's going to mean.
And what do each of you think are some of those policy decisions that need to be thought through?
Megan, do you want to go first?
I mean, I think there are a number of different things that are being considered right now to help manage student debt. I mean, there are proposals right now to, streamline some of our income-based repayment programs, which I think is a really great program that, we have a couple different income-based repayment programs right now, and to make that more simple and easy to understand for students. There's actually some proposals out there right now that would make it so that everybody would enter into an income-based repayment program, meaning that your loan payment would be a certain percentage of your income and would not be any more than that. There are a couple other countries that do that right now, and so I think that's something that folks on the Hill are thinking about, and we as an organization are thinking about what that would look like. And I think there's also a broader debate, too, about the fact that, yes, we've seen more borrowing and students and families having to really shoulder the burden of paying for college costs and education, but I think a bigger public policy issue is what's happening at the state level and the state investment and the federal investment in the grant programs. I mean, we haven't seen those keep pace with the pace that we've seen college costs increase. And so I think, you know, we're also trying to have real conversations about investing in the students of this country and putting more money into these programs.
Anything to add there, Betsy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we also are looking to sort of change the way that families shop for college. You know, I think I mentioned earlier, families should shop for college the way they shop for other consumer goods. You need to do a cost-benefit analysis. You need to know going in what the total cost is going to be. You know, we as a country have made the decision to fund higher education on debt. And I think what we're seeing now is the result of a real lack of financial literacy resources and education. And I think that going forward, we're already starting to see it, a lot broader policy discussion that not only talks about student loans, but overall ensuring that there are resources for families to give them the education, the financial literacy education and the counseling education they need to manage this type of student debt.
That's Betsy Mayott, who's Director of Regulatory Compliance at American Student Assistance, a nonprofit that helps students and alumni successfully manage and repay their college loan debt. We're also joined by Megan McLean, Director for Policy and Advocacy at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, an organization that works to remove barriers and provide education for student financial aid. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798 Talk. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And Betsy and Megan, I'm wondering about the stress that comes with having such large amounts of debt coming into an economy where last year's graduates have an 11% unemployment rate. It seems awfully intimidating for students to graduate and begin their professional careers, you know, already so deep in the hole. Any thoughts on managing that stress?
Being educated about it, knowing ahead of time what your options are, and, you know, if your listeners remember nothing else about this hour of conversation, if you're struggling or if you think you might struggle in the future, call your loan holder. Especially with federal student loans, there's almost always something that can be done to help provide some relief, whether it be temporary or long-term, to make sure that this debt doesn't cause you more stress than necessary.
Well, can you talk a little bit about how that restructuring of debt works? So I graduate, I've worked really hard, maybe I haven't paid that much attention to my loans. You know, maybe I was 18 or 19 when I went into this whole thing. Now I realize that, boy, I got myself in over my head. How do I go about restructuring this debt? And why are student loans different than other consumer loans?
Well, student loans have a lot more benefits available than most other types of consumer loans. There's a multitude of lower payment options. We've talked a little bit about the income-based repayment options. There's actually four or five different income-based related programs. There's also the ability to consolidate the loans, which if someone has a higher debt, that will extend the payment and therefore, extend the term and therefore lower the payment. You can, some people are able to, use the interest they pay on their student loans as a deduction on their taxes, which is something else that's not available on other types of consumer debt. If you're unemployed, it's possible to get a deferment. If you're just in an economic hardship situation, you can receive a deferment. There's a myriad of other options. I could take another hour on your show to go over them.
All right. Well, let's go to more callers. Let's go to Sayuri in Berkeley. Hi, Sayuri. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Tell us.
So, as a recent college graduate, I graduated in December of 2013. And so what I had was that if there's any conversations going on the high school level, because I remember when I was first applying, there was this glamour in applying, but never really the reality of having a conversation with students. And then coming from a first-generation college family, we never had a conversation with family members who really didn't know how the American education system worked, and then just had preparing high school students if there was anything ready for them to even have a conversation with family members who may not be aware of, I guess, the feasibility and the real responsibilities of affording a college education.
Any wisdom on that? Is this happening in high schools?
You know, I think that is an excellent point, and I think that we're working very hard, I think even at the federal level, to try to instill some a sense of college-going behavior and financial literacy related to the federal student aid programs earlier and earlier. We actually, several of our financial aid administrators will participate in college nights and actually go into the high schools and talk about the application, talk about the different kind of aid that's available. And I would just say at the federal level, Congress is even talking about maybe instituting some early information and early awareness programs that would get students talking about the feasibility of college and grants and loans as early as 7th or 8th grade.
Yeah, and that seems especially important, as Sayuri points out, if you've got large numbers of first-generation college students coming out of high schools.
Absolutely.
Sayuri, did you have anything that you wanted to add to tell us about your own situation? Did you come out in debt?
Yes, I did. I made the choice because of the amount of loans I had to take. I opted to go to the community college route, take my prerequisites, and then go into transfer into a UC system. So I came out with much less debt. But
well, it sounds like you were pretty savvy about it.
I say that's a smart choice.
Yeah, it's a really good strategy.
But I think there is slightly a stigma still in high schools where I feel like community college isn't seen as a valid option, even though it makes a lot of financial sense. And I think there still needs to be, I guess, destigmatizing that notion as well, because it made a lot of sense. It didn't make a lot of sense initially. I was really heartbroken that I couldn't go to my first choices of schools, but knowing the amount of debt I'd personally be in, you know, going into that option of taking a year to go to take my class at community college was a very feasible one, and I'm glad. But I still came out of it with, you know, $20,000 in loans.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Sayuri, and very great insights for us to think about. Let's go next to Bill in Mill Valley. Hi, Bill. Welcome to your call.
Hi. How are you? So the point I wanted to make was that it seems to me that the whole financing system for colleges and universities is taking the wealth of the students and their families and transferring that to the colleges and to the lenders. If you think about it, the student loan, which is deferred in the long run, doesn't really help the student. It just defers that debt. And private colleges and universities, particularly, and even state institutions, are competing on the basis of their fabulous institutions that they build. So you go to the college on an interview and you see these huge stadiums and huge academic buildings and laboratories, et cetera, all of which are very expensive, and they finance them with debt, and they use the student loan program to pay the tuition for all those facilities. And as a result of that, when the student goes to choose a college, he doesn't really think about the cost. He thinks about how great the institution is. And so the colleges have insulated themselves from any marketplace where they would have to compete on the basis of cost.
Any response to Bill, Betsy or Megan?
Yeah, I think Bill, you know, I mentioned this earlier, we need to teach families that they need to shop for college like the way they shop for other consumer goods. And I think this is a great example. You know, if your child was shopping for a car and wanted the prettiest, shiniest one that also happened to be the most expensive one, the first reaction wouldn't be, well, we have to find a way to finance that. The first reaction would be, no, we need to find the car that meets our budget, that provides what we're looking for, whether it be all-weather tires or low gas mileage. And that's the way we need to shop for college. You know,
I feel like, though, Betsy, let me push back on that just a little bit. I feel like education is a very different thing than a car. I mean, you know, you're looking at this as perhaps the biggest investment in your child's future. So there's a lot more riding on it than there would be in a pretty car.
That's true. However, you know, Bill made the comment that, you know, that the student maybe sees the fabulous campus and falls in love with the campus. I'd like to see families do a little more research on whatever interests the student, whatever program they're maybe enrolling in. Is that, you know, bang for the buck, is that the best rated program, I should say, for the money, and that meets their budget.
And Betsy, I want to make sure that we get to the issue of default and what happens and how can you navigate going into default if you've fallen into it before our show is over. So can you talk about that? Loans are typically
sure.
considered in default after what, payments are past due for more than 270 days?
Yes, in the federal student loan program, legally the loan would be considered in default after day 270. Sometimes after that time, you might have a month or two to sort of bring it back from the brink, so to speak. But once the loan is in default, in addition to the terrible hit that your credit report would take, they will add up to 25% in collection costs to the balance of the loan. You're no longer eligible for federal aid nor any of the lower payment or deferment options. They can do wage garnishment. They can do tax refund garnishment. So there are ways out of default. Other than paying the loan in full, the borrower can either go through what's called the rehabilitation program, where they would make 9 consecutive on-time payments, at which point the loan's taken out of default, and the default line's actually taken off their credit report like it was never there, which is a great benefit.
Do lenders sometimes have an incentive to put loans in default? Like in the case of Sallie Mae, do they end up getting paid more?
No, they actually end up getting paid less. Lenders, and keep in mind that particular loan program no longer makes new loans and hasn't made new loans since 2010. So in the case of the direct loan program, there's actually no incentive they get paid a lot less if the loan were to go into default. In the case of that older lender-based federally guaranteed program, again, the lender would get paid less in the long run if the loan defaulted than if the borrower were to pay as agreed.
And let me go to one more caller. Let me squeeze in William from Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you very much. I think in many policies, social policies, one can learn a great deal from what's happening elsewhere, and we are one world these days, particularly with communication. So my question is, what happens in other countries? What's the situation in Europe? Are people having giant loans to pay off if they go to school? Or what is it that we could learn from what might be succeeding elsewhere?
Thank you, William. Yeah, let's get a quick answer, Betsy or Megan, and then go to final thoughts.
I'll say from our standpoint, building off something I said before, at least on the back end in terms of repayment, I think other countries are doing something interesting, which is putting everybody into income-based repayment and even some of them having it come out of their paycheck. And I can't speak for what all the other countries are doing, but from a comparison standpoint, that's something that we've been looking at. That's not obviously tackling the issue of upfront costs, but we think there's a lot to be learned from the way that students are repaying their loans in other countries.
And in many other countries, higher education is much more fully subsidized.
That's right.
Let's go to just final thoughts, and we have just a couple of minutes. Maybe the top 3 tips for consumers and the top 3 political reforms that you advocate. Go ahead. You start us off, Betsy.
Well, the top 3 tips I'd have for consumers is, again, number 1, if you think you're going to get in trouble with your federal student debt, absolutely call your loan holder. There's also a lot of other free resources out there. Number 2, when you're shopping for college, shop for college. Do your research. Use the College Navigator. Do the cost-benefit and long-term debt analysis before you pick. And my third tip, I guess, when it comes to federal student loan debt is, try to take on, do things like we talked to Sayori earlier. See if there's a way that you can save in the debt by maybe attending a lower price college to do your core classes, and then the classes attached to your major, you can go to your school of your choice.
And what about top 3 priorities for political reforms on these issues?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that one of the top priorities should be to ensure that consumers have the tools they need to make those choices and to counsel them on the debt. Financial literacy resources and independent counselors available to help people with their student debts.
I think we need to look at overall college financing. Can the programs be streamlined? There's been talks of a one loan, one grant. I don't know if that's the answer, but I definitely think it should be examined more fully. And I agree with Megan that we need to put some policies in place to get the states back into the business of subsidizing higher education to help control those costs and make it more affordable.
And Megan, you've got about a minute for your final thoughts.
Okay, great. Thanks. I would just say in terms of tips as you listen today and walk away, the first thing I would say is just to remember that the cost of college is also a part of the fit. And that really echoes a lot of what Betsy has said, but you look at a lot of other things in a university or college. Does it have the right major? Is it located in the right place? Do I like the faculty? Cost is a piece of fit as well. I would also just make the recommendation that you pay close attention to your award letter and that you know that whatever you are packaged with in terms of federal student loans, it doesn't mean you have to take that amount. You can actually take less. And that ties into my third tip, which is utilize the financial aid office, talk to the financial aid administrators. That's what they're there for. They want to help. They want to talk to you. And they want to see you borrow as least amount as you can. From a public policy standpoint, we're working on a lot of initiatives right now to try to move the application process earlier by using earlier year income. We call that prior year income. That would get students information earlier, and they'd have a longer time to make decisions. We are trying to advocate for a program that would make the Pell Grant more flexible to the current needs of non-traditional students, and we're also very focused on indebtedness and the back end. So how can we restructure and streamline repayment so that it's fair and equitable for students?
Well, thank you both so much. That was Megan McLean, Director for Policy and Advocacy at the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
And Betsy Mayotte is Director of Regulatory Compliance at American Student Assistance. We will put links to more web resources along with their information at yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there, post resources there. Thanks to everybody who called. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How can we improve diversity in environmental organizations? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how people of color are significantly underrepresented in environmental groups, especially at the leadership level. A recent study calls it a green ceiling, noting that people of color make up only 12-16% of most environmental organizations. So how is this affecting the priorities and strategies of the environmental movement? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.